Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Brakes? We can save you 15% on that. We have OE quality Duralast brake pads and rotors in stock, ready for pickup or delivery. We also have calipers, brake fluid, tools, and anything else you'll need to do the job right. When you get Duralast pads and rotors together, you'll save 15%. It's just part of what makes us America's number one brakes destination.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, listener mail. This is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today's the day we bring you messages that you've sent in over the past couple of weeks. So today we've got some messages about the Kuleshov effect, about vault episodes on mushroom foraging. But I think first we're going to start off with a response to our series on tumbleweeds.
Yes. Now, I have to say, and this is something that you pointed out, we have fewer messages than we usually have. So I'm going to try and speak very slowly. And hopefully, okay, if I pause enough, we'll be able to go 30 minutes or so here.
Oh, that's a brilliant idea. Excuse me, that is a brilliant idea.
All right, I don't know if we can sustain this. I'll probably go back to normal speed here.
They can easily defeat us by just going to the 2x speed or whatever on playback.
That's right. They're just, and then, but then we'll cause like some sort of whiplash if we go super slow and then we start speeding up again. And we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that to the listeners.
Folks, have we annoyed you enough today already? Or
All right, let's jump into it. This one comes to us from Bill. It's titled Tumbleweeds. Bill writes, "Your show has edutained me for years, but I am shocked that of all the fascinating topics that you have covered, it is the seed spreading of dead flora that has brought in the most email. I am in southern Utah, which has a huge supply of Russian thistle that rolls around the area, gets caught in the dust devils, which elevate them hundreds of feet above the terrain, and of course clog up drainage ditches, slot canyons, and even damages cars if the central, quote-unquote, trunk of the bush is large enough to damage the frail plastic of modern cars. Some of these beasts can reach 8 to 10 feet in diameter. My job, throwing people off of cliffs, keeps me surrounded by these mesmerizing rolling nuisances as I hike and climb through remote desert areas. Of all the places where you don't want to tangle with these are in some of the slot canyons of Lake Powell. There are places where one has to wade and swim through 100 yards of lake-soaked tumbleweeds that could easily be 5 to 10 feet thick from the lake bottom to just below the surface. They quickly sink, but take quite a while to fully break down. This leaves years, if not decades, of submerged spiky residue to contend with. Keep up your amazing content and delivery, Bill.
Wow, what a hellish scene you have described. So, like, slot canyons that have water at the bottom, and then that water is just full of, like, years of buildup of slowly rotting tumbleweeds.
Yeah, I love this detail. We're learning more and more about the devastation wrought by the Russian thistle. I'm assuming the job of throwing people off of cliffs here is some sort of, like, bungee cord-related venture.
You know, base jumping or something. Yeah, I don't know. I hope this is not a confession from a serial killer in our mailbox.
He's just a crazed desert dweller that throws people off of cliffs whenever he finds them.
But he does not clarify, so I guess we'll just have to assume the best.
Quantum state.
All right, are you ready for this message from Lauren on our Vault episodes about mushroom foraging?
Oh, yes.
Okay, Lauren says, hello, Robert and Joe. And then she starts off by saying some very nice things about the show and talks about how she started listening to us this past December and has been exploring a bunch of our episodes ever since then. So Lauren begins, after listening to the second Vault episode about mushroom foraging, the information about the two types of fruit flies made me think about the times in my youth when I very occasionally played Super Mario on the Nintendo 64, the one where you jump through paintings to enter worlds with goals to complete. For people who haven't revisited the mushroom episodes recently, we should probably do a quick refresher on what the deal with the different foraging styles was. Basically, the idea here is that research has identified a gene found in a variety of animals called PRKG1 and found that in some very different animals, though a lot of the research is in fruit flies, which variant of this gene you have, which PRKG1 allele you have, seems to correlate with preferences in foraging behavior. And in fruit flies, at least, they identify two distinct types of foragers that are called sitters and rovers. And these two styles have various implications, but the simplified version is that sitters tend to be more conservative in their foraging patterns. So they will stick close to the boundaries of established foraging areas, and they have shorter paths of exploration, whereas rovers tend to be more adventurous. They tend to explore foraging environments with long search paths and a greater tendency to dive right into the exposed center of open foraging areas. So there are probably a lot of implications to this, but it seems at least possible that this may have something to do with risk aversion, right? That sitters, by sticking to more established foraging regions and sticking close to sheltered boundary areas of foraging zones, they take fewer risks, but of course they also suffer opportunity costs compared to the rovers, which may be, you know, taking more risks by just sort of venturing right out into open space, but they're also more likely to discover new food sources by doing that. There is some research to indicate that possessing different variants of a foraging-associated gene might also be correlated with similar behavior preferences in humans, though that's the kind of assumption that I'm always a little bit cautious about. So I'd want really good research basis before going whole hog on that foraging gene type idea in humans. But anyway, to come back to Lauren, this, I remember she was talking about Super Mario 64. Which, yes. I remember that game fondly. I love jumping into the paintings, too.
You know, I don't think I ever played this one, but I had to look it up to see which one it was. I'm vaguely familiar with Mario, Super Mario 64. But I was surprised to see that it's apparently popped up in different peer-reviewed medical studies.
Yeah,
where they'll be testing something or another, studying something or another, and they will have test subjects play Super Mario 64. Now, I'm not sure if there's something special about Mario 64 that makes it the ideal thing to make your test subjects do, but fascinating nonetheless.
Well, it's a rather magical game. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody out there at some point found that a little bit of Super Mario 64 was good for what ails you, at least to maybe in dispelling certain types of dysphoria or something. I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, so it's a game where you jump through paintings to go into different like subworlds. And so Lauren picks back up in her original email. When I'd enter a painting world for the first time, or for the first time in a while, I would always walk or swim the perimeter of the world to get a sense of the boundaries of the terrain. I wanted to know which directions were worth traveling in, and also, if I was going to search the entire terrain, I thought it best to cover the small pockets in full before expanding my search, so that I didn't have to return later or repeatedly, unnecessarily. I did this with Zelda as well. After listening to this episode, I got to wondering about the expectations of video game developers. If they anticipate their players to have a, quote, run into the center and aim for the biggest attraction or enemy sort of mindset, or if they expect players to behave in other ways. I wondered if, for certain games, I was being set up for success or failure not based on my intelligence, but on the preferences and possible genetics of the video game creator who established these rules to the game without considering the possibility that people hunt and gather in different ways. Thanks again, Lauren. Yeah, I think this is really interesting, Lauren, because I don't know what I think about how strongly determinant a single foraging gene could be on the behaviors of humans, but for whatever reason, I think I am very much a sitter fly when it comes to virtual environments in video games. When I'm playing a video game, I hate having to run into the middle of previously unexplored territory. I'm a cautious explorer. I like to understand the landscape before I enter. I survey it from the sheltered periphery, look at it from high ground, and so forth.
I mean, I guess different games they reward different types of behavior. Some games are certainly going to maybe be broader in their approach and play tested in different ways to where you can take multiple strategies. But this is a great question. I'd love to hear from anyone out there with more familiarity with the game design world. It does remind me a little bit of the situation if I remember correctly, with Fallout 76, when it came out. I think the idea with that was they were like, all right, we're going to get all these people into this virtual shared Fallout world, and they're just going to fight each other, and they're going to have a great time fighting each other. And it turns out, like, most people playing it didn't actually want to fight each other. They wanted to do other things. And so there was a period of time during which I was playing the game where even though the game wanted you to kill each other, people were tending to do the opposite, and they were trying to do something more communal. And then eventually the game developers, the game masters, kind of catch up with that and kind of shift the shape of the virtual environment to meet the way people wanted to actually play the game.
It's interesting. I never played that game. The only thing I know you've mentioned it a couple of times, but I think the only other thing I've seen about it was that for some reason people were mad about it. Like, was it buggy or something?
I'm trying to even remember. It may have been buggy at first. I mean, not catastrophically so. I enjoyed playing. I must have played it pretty steadily for over a year. It was kind of a comfort food for me for a little bit there.
I got to say, I rather enjoy a buggy game sometimes. I get a lot of pleasure out of that.
Yeah, I mean, the a lot of these bugs become memes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I would love to hear more about this because I guess nowadays you tend to have games that are created by large groups, and hopefully those groups will be like diverse enough in their mindset to where somebody at some point will be like, well, hey, what if you don't want to run into the middle of this room? What if you want to, play more like a rogue or something? Should we make space for that to happen? But then I wonder if that was less likely during the era of, more like a sole developer on a video game.
Yeah, I wonder. Then again, I guess there might also be just different types of games that appeal more to the sitter type personality versus the rover type personality. Like, there are certain types of games that there are a ton of in our generation that I just don't ever enjoy at all. Like the military shooter type games that hold like no appeal for me. But it seems like maybe they'd be more appealing to somebody with kind of more of a rover personality who likes to just run in and start shooting at anything that moves.
Yeah. Though I, even in those games, I remember, back in the days of Doom, like the original Doom and the original Quake and those games, you'd have people who wanted to camp out, to just hang out in one spot on the map and then just snipe people when they moved in. And I think some of these games like Half-Life eventually caught up with that and said, okay, well, let's make sure there are different roles for these different types of players within a given like deathmatch situation.
Oh yeah, I guess they're usually. You probably can tell I don't play multiplayer games very much, but they're usually like different player classes in those games, right?
Yeah. All right, should we move on to the next one here?
Sure, let's go for it.
This one comes from Brenda, and this has to do with their episode on the Klushov effect. Hi, Robert and Joe. I'm a longtime listener and love your show. I'm currently recovering from COVID, and as such, have had an unusual amount of free time as I cannot go to work. I've been using this time to catch up on my favorite podcasts, and yours always takes the top spot. I just finished listening to the Klushov Effect episodes, and the thing that came to mind for me was memes. We have a whole culture of intentionally taking expressions and clips out of context and matching them with whatever images or blurbs fit what we would like to express. The popular woman screaming at a cat meme comes to mind. Perhaps it is not a perfect connection, but it seems to me that in the age of social media, the edit is more important than the actor. Thanks, Brenda.
Yeah, this is a good point. I don't know if it. So there's one big difference, I think, with the alleged Kuleshov effect in the original Mazhukin experiment, which was supposedly that it was like an expressionless face on that the actor was using, and then that was paired with whatever. Most, I think, meme faces are not usually expressionless. They're like, I don't know, they've got some kind of directed content, but then you fill in a blank in the sentence that's implied by the meme with whatever the subject of the meme is, you know, the thing it's reacting to or the text you put on it and so forth.
Yeah, I'm instantly thinking of a lot of these meme faces where yeah, it's pretty obvious what the emotional impact is supposed to be. A lot of times it's this versus that. Like it's the woman making the disgusted face and then the, you know, considering it face, or it's Drake saying, no, he doesn't want this. And then saying, yes, he does want this. Right. So there's not a lot of ambiguity. Maybe I'm just not thinking of a good example, but, I off the top of my head, I'm not thinking of any meme faces that leave a lot of room to imagine what that individual thinks of the thing that they're supposedly looking at or considering.
But I do think, nevertheless, there's really something going here, because the meme culture, I think, connects more to the Kuleshovian vision of filmmaking, where you would just have these sort of like endlessly rearrangeable building blocks that are then the editor uses them to make meaning in endless combinations. So, I mean, and memes are kind of that way. It's not so much that, you know, you're seeing neutral faces that you're reading expressions onto because of the context, but you are seeing things that are just treated as building blocks that can be repurposed to any situation.
Yeah.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
All right, this next message is also about the Kuleshov effect. This is from somebody. I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce your name. It's spelled D-I-O-N. That might be Dion or Dion. I'm not sure. I'll try Dion. Dion says, "Dear Rob and Joe and Stuff to Blow Your Mind crew, massive fan of the show. I just had to make this contribution to your discussion of the Kuleshov effect. I hope you find it useful or interesting. It's worth considering the role of another editing element of the modern film, and that is sound. Kuleshov's work was done before fully synchronized sound, although it is worth noting that music almost always played a role in cinema in the West. It's commonly cited that music was used to cover up the sound of the noisy film projectors of the day." Oh, yeah, I can only imagine what kind of clattering racket those things would have made. But the email goes on, "But beyond that, there are many examples of sound being used in the same way we use modern score. That is, to influence or manipulate an audience's perceptions or emotions, and ultimately drive the film narrative. Michel Chion," and this is the name of a French filmmaker and composer, "talks about a concept called added value. Added value is where images on screen and sound combine to create new meaning. This meaning is greater, different, or more complex than the original meaning of each part in isolation." And then Dion gives the example of how you can use like atmospheric sound paired with a shot of an apartment interior to set very different kinds of scenes. Like you might hear kind of birds twittering and breeze blowing, in which case you assume this apartment is somewhere in kind of like a peaceful countryside setting, or you might hear like loud traffic and horns honking and the bustle of people and voices, in which case you assume that the apartment is somewhere in the city and it's urban and things are happening and busy. Dion writes, "Each scenario sets the scene for a completely different narrative, while the picture remains the same. Actually, sound does this in a very economical way, very quickly, without even drawing our awareness to it. I recommend Chion's book, Audio Vision, Sound on Screen, since you're interested in this nerdier side of film." This was published in English in 1994. Chion's work corresponds with the availability of videotape, which simplified the repetitive study of filmic material in a classroom setting. Oh, that's a funny detail. I don't know if I've ever put that together before, but I wonder how the advent of home video changed trends in film criticism and film theory, just because it suddenly would become so much easier to re-watch films and seen from films.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly remember as a kid, the films that I loved, and of course, I feel like oftentimes when you're a kid, you do watch things over and over again, but mm-hmm. I would put things on like slow motion loops when possible. You know, it'd be like the melting scenes in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it wasn't enough to just watch it once. You know, you had to slow it down. You had to freeze frame and all of this. So it's, you know, thank goodness those effects were really solid.
Watching that Nazi turn to soup, it made you the man you are today. But yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
But if I had had, you know, if I'd wanted to, and I had more of an appreciation for the, you know, the actual you know, art and craft of cinema at the time, that is the kind of thing I could have looked to. I could have slowed it down and asked myself, well, what is you know, what is Spielberg actually doing here? How is he pulling me in with this particular sequence? How is it cut? And then how might I recreate the same thing?
Absolutely. But to come back to the email, Dion writes, to bring this back to Kuleshov's idea of the manipulation of an image, I used to teach a subject about film sound, and we would do an exercise that was always really effective. It went like this. You would choose a short section of film. You'd choose some music from a variety of genres, like horror, romantic comedy, drama, etc., and then you'd play back the scene with the new music and discuss the results. Simple, but effective. We would do this in groups, and I found over the years that the driving to the Bates Motel scene in Hitchcock's Psycho from 1960 was very effective for this exercise. And then Dion provides a link to the scene, which I did a little experiment with. I paired up the Psycho scene with Janet Leigh with the Silver Shamrock music from Season of the Witch, and it did indeed produce a different effect, though I don't know if it was I guess the effect it produced was well within the wheelhouse of the movie Psycho already.
Would you say that she appeared more irritated than
yes.
than afraid?
Yes. Or maybe I would say that, honestly, the idea that came to my head was she was afraid that she found herself hating her own children because they were singing this song so much.
Yeah. I can. I have not tried this myself, but just looking at it, I'm imagining like some of the stuff you could drop in. You could certainly drop in some other forms of tense music. You could also drop in something that's maybe a little more emotional. You know, like I'm thinking some sort of modern, I don't know, Lana Del Rey sort of music. You know, and it would take on I think a different vibe.
Well, I like what Dion says, which is, quote, I was always surprised by the new possibilities. Without going into them all, I recall watching the scene to a disco track, and this had the scene taking on the sense of a cheesy romantic comedy. All of a sudden, Janet Leigh's nuanced performance is turned into simply before date jitters. I can totally okay. see that, all and right. I love it. That I think it works. Dion says, of course, the face remains the same, but we attribute different meaning to it as per the Kuleshov effect. I found the temporal nature of the results interesting, too. Some music choices would give the sense of leaving something behind, while some would create tension about the future, like the original score. And then Dion encourages us to take a few moments to try it for ourselves, like the kind I already described. This part I thought was really interesting, that certain pairings would cause you to see the emotion on her face as reactive to something that already happened, and others would cause you to see it as anticipatory.
I didn't actually play it, but I've been watching it the whole time, and I was just running ABBA's Dancing Queen through my head whilst looking at it, and I can sort of get the point here about like sort of the disco vibes and how that would potentially steer interpretation.
Like it turns the paranoia that she has about the fact that she stole all this money in the movie and is worried about what's going to happen. It turns that into, that is what happened in that scene, right? Didn't she take a bunch of money and run away?
I believe so. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It turns that into like being worried about what people are going to think about her at the party or something. Anyway, the email goes on. Perhaps at odds to all of this, there are quite a number of studies that display the primacy of vision over sound. White noise is regarded as more pleasant when associated with the picture of a waterfall, for example, and red trains are louder. And then there are links to a couple of citations for this. Abe et al., 1999, in the study called The Effects of Visual Information on the Impression of Environmental Sounds, and then Fostel et al. In 2004, Audiovisual Interactions in Loudness Evaluation. But then finally, Dion cites something called the McGurk effect. The McGurk effect is an example of this idea of visual dominance. This is an interesting and persistent illusion credited to cognitive psychologists McGurk and McDonald in 1976. Rob, here's a visual example I linked to that you can check out for yourself, but I'll try to explain it. So if you watch video of somebody making a sound repeatedly, the example I found was a man just saying ba, 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 like a sheep, B-A-H, mm-hmm. over and over. And something very strange happens if you continue playing the same audio, but substitute in video of the guy looking like he's making an F sound with his mouth. So it would be fa, 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 even though the audio doesn't change. At least on me, I absolutely hear fa, 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 even though technically the audio is the same ba, ba, ba as it was before.
Interesting.
And the at least subjectively, the effect is profound on me. I I absolutely hear fa, fa, fa. It's as if that's what he was actually saying. Anyway, Dion finishes up by saying that they're working toward their PhD, doing research in sound design of film dialogue, and ends up saying some very nice things about the show, and in saying, I love the stuff and could talk about it all day, but I'll stop now. Warm regards, Dion.
Oh.
Well, thanks. This was a really great email.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to busy myself now with playing different works of music over that Psycho scene.
I think Janet Leigh's face in the Psycho scene is yet another good example of a face that is ambiguous but not neutral. You could read multiple things into it. Though I guess it would be hard to imagine that she looks happy, but you could read multiple different kinds of negative emotion into her face.
All right, let's do one more here. This one comes to us from Morgan. Morgan writes, "Hey fellas, love the show, and I hope you're doing well. I just wanted to address your comments regarding the Witcher drawing his sword. While they don't appear this way in the games, and it's not explicitly addressed in the books, in the show, the TV show, the scabbard is not continuous, in that it essentially just holds the tip of the sword in place, and a strap secures it toward the hilt. A scabbard designed this way would allow the blade to move independently of the length scabbard until it clears the strap at the top. Also, the books usually point out that Geralt loosens the strap on his scabbard when he may need to draw, allowing for further mobility. Additionally, and semi-related, only in the games does the Witcher carry two swords at once. Typically, if he's carrying a sword on his back, it's just the one he needs to use for the current foe. His other remains in the carrying case on the saddle. I've attached an image below which shows the scabbard." And yep, there it is.
All right. Now, if you're totally confused by this, I think this person is responding to me in a previous listener mail saying that the Witcher's sword would not work. But I was talking about in the video games, because in the video games, he wears his sword in a full scabbard. It's like a solid scabbard encasing the blade, but on his back. And I was just pointing out, you can't draw a sword like that because your arm is not long enough to get it out of the scabbard if it's on your back. But so on the show, it sounds like they've got a workaround for that by saying, well, the scabbard isn't actually solid. It's just like the tip point is solid, and then there's a strap. So he'd have to loosen the strap and then pull it out a little bit, and then he can just, like, he doesn't have to pull it out the full length because it's not actually solid all the way around.
Yeah. This makes me want to do something on swords again. I know we've covered swords and blades and weapons to a certain degree in the past.
I know you love swords, man.
Well, I mean, you know, a movie with a good sword scene.
Oh, yeah.
A good sword fight. A good sword fight's hard to find in a motion picture.
I'm game.
Sword fight that tells a story. I do vaguely remember, yeah, you get into, like, the history of various styles of sword play, and it gets pretty fascinating. Like, there are all these sort of distinct martial art forms that in some cases are, you know, partially forgotten, but also easy to, you know, to not recognize when you just see an illustration of the image. Especially, I'm thinking of some of these, you know, very large swords. You just sort of think, well, you just go up there and you start swinging it around, right? But no, there's a particular form. There's a particular way that you would use this weapon effectively in combat. Maybe that's an episode. We do one on great swords, you know?
Like, okay.
Really big swords. And what circumstances do they make sense? And then how often do we see that same logic applied to video games or scenes in fantasy movies?
All right, man. I'm there.
All right. All right, we're going to go ahead and call it there, but obviously we'd love to hear from everybody. If you have thoughts on anything we've discussed here today, we can talk about it in a future listener mail episode. We do these every Monday. Our core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind come out on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Wednesday, we do a short form artifact episode, and on Friday, that's when we do Weird Al Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious matters and just discuss a weird film.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.